Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, we talked about seafood. We want to talk all about seafood today.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to run things where we have a really fascinating interview coming up in the first segment.
Yes.
With a gentleman from the seafood industry who's a marine biologist and has a lot of experience in the industry and experience in sustainability and can educate us on this a bit. The second segment, we want to talk recipes.
Yes, for sure.
And what's exciting to cook and exactly what to do with it.
Yep, we're in a good place for it.
In that third segment, we'll spend a few minutes on wine and fish.
Okay.
Can you put red wine with fish? Hmm. Sort of terrible question, right? And a chef's challenge.
All right, let's do it.
As we always do.
All right.
So on the line, we have Joseph Laspregata, the Vice President of Samuels & Sons Seafood in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He has a 30-year career of being in the seafood industry. Mostly with Samuels & Son, was educated as a marine biologist from Long Island University. So let's talk a little bit of seafood. Joe, thanks for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, so, Cindy. How are you today?
Very well. Excited to talk to you.
So just a few moments about you. You started out as studying marine biology. Was that a particular fascination when you were growing up?
Yeah, it was something I had interested in. We'd always spent our summers down in Ocean City, New Jersey, and I always had a fascination with the ocean, and kind of led me in that direction.
What got you from that into the seafood industry?
Well, I had hoped to develop a career as the next Jacques Cousteau, but unfortunately that didn't work out, so I needed to earn a living, so I started working in the seafood industry back on Long Island buying tunas for the sushi trade.
So what was it like when you were first buying tuna for the sushi trade? About when did you get started?
This was back about 1984, 1985. Ronald Reagan was still president of the United States, and sushi bars had just started opening up in the U.S., primarily in New York and on the West Coast, and L.A. and San Francisco.
What was coming in then? What was the tuna that was coming in at that time?
It was primarily a swordfish fishery. This is up on Long Island. We were buying tunas out of Montauk and Shinnecock and ports along the east coast there. The tuna at that time were really a byproduct. And it was just about then that, again, I mentioned the sushi bars started opening up and there was a demand for fresh tuna. Prior to that time, you know, the only time people had seen tuna fish was coming out of a can.
Hmm.
So the company I was working for at the time was, we were exporting tunas to Skeegee Market. When I had started, it was primarily buying big eyes and larger yellowfins that had the higher fat content. But as I had mentioned, the sushi bars were opening up, so there was a domestic market for fresh tuna, fresh sashimi-grade tuna that wasn't really there prior to this time, and that's when we started kind of developing that industry. And then from there, there was actually a joint venture that was started with the company I was working for with a company down in Panama City, Florida, and we were buying tunas from the longline boats down there that had been converted from the American Snapper fleet that had collapsed due to overfishing at the time, and they were all switching over to longline tuna.
At that time, Cindy and I both were starting cooking in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
The swordfish was pretty darn popular, wasn't it?
Swordfish, yeah. Swordfish was very popular. In fact, it was so popular, and there were so many boats fishing for it that it actually had caused it to partially collapse, and they had to highly regulate it.
So is this a pattern you've seen happen sometimes over your career?
You know, the management of fisheries is a very difficult thing, and it's not only a national issue, but also, of course, a worldwide issue that fortunately, you know, many countries and many organizations are now paying attention to, and hopefully it's not too late to manage them in such a way where they come back.
So I'm curious because I think we're all about the same vintage. At that time, what else was really popular? What else were people squawking for? And
well, the Bee Gees were pretty popular back then, and during the time we didn't really have the variety of different seafoods that we. I mean, they were available, but they were more regional.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of. I mean, there was certainly for us there was plenty of crab on the menu.
Right, crabs were always popular.
Rockfish and.
I would say the thing that was sort of coming into vogue at the time was the Chilean sea bass, which was sort of a byproduct and not really heard of in the United States at that time. And then, as the years progress, you see now, it's probably one of the most sought after and one of the most expensive fish that are available.
Which, that seems kind of crazy to me.
Well, everything's about the market. There was a time... You would never, remember, back, you were talking about back in the early 80s, you would see squid or calamari on the menu rarely. You would have to go to your favorite Italian restaurant.
Yeah.
Now you can, you go to Fridays and you can get it on the menu. It's just everywhere, it's just people's tastes change. And of course, the chefs are always ever looking for that next new item or new fish. And certainly that's true with squid and a number of other things.
Maybe give us some perspective, changes from then to, say, 95, 2005, and 2015, 16.
Well, I would say from the 80s into the 90s, thanks for making me feel old, Tony. That's really great.
Like I said, I think we're all about in the same neighborhood, okay?
I would say
with the Bee Gees comment too.
Yeah, a lot of the West Coast species were kind of came in vogue in the 90s. You started hearing more about the Pacific salmons and how wonderful they are. And then, of course, halibut was never seen on the East Coast. Started to become in vogue, especially as those fisheries progressed. And the most important thing about seafood is the transportation, and there was. Between the air freight and some of the trucking logistics, bringing product all the way literally from Alaska, allowed us to have the availability of these species that you would only see seasonally over on the West Coast. And then I guess as we progress into the 2000s, I'd have to say the advent of some higher quality aquacultured products. Certainly, if you look at the oyster industry and what that's done in the last 15 years, it's amazing. Back when if we go back to the mid-80s, the oyster industry, the wild oyster industry, had just about collapsed, something that even the Chesapeake is just recovering from now due to the very hard work of some very good organizations. And if we fast forward into the 2000s, you see all these the aquaculture situations for these different oyster producers are just wonderful. It's just a tremendous source of a high quality protein that is once again, and I think it's great, regularly seen on very many menus now. Buck a shuck night is commonplace, and that's a wonderful night to go out with your date and sit down and order a selection of oysters, both East and West Coast, pair them up with some fabulous wines, and you have a great evening ahead of you.
Yeah, that's super fun. And taking us to now, what is the latest stuff that you've seen happen in the last couple of years?
I would say that over the last couple of years, it's chefs are funny. When I first started,
chefs are hilarious.
Hey, wait a minute.
But, you may be able to support me on this or not, but originally chefs wanted the most way out, far out product they could find. If it came from Mars, they had to have it and they wanted it on their menu. Now people, are finally, gained a little common sense and see the value of products that are produced locally with a smaller carbon footprint. Some products that were considered to be... I hate the term. They would use the term trash fish, which is completely unfair. We prefer, underutilized species. But people are coming back to bluefish and monkfish. You certainly see things like skate, things that were considered a byproduct of the scallop industry. being put on menus as a regular thing. You know, porgies, which a fishery that has really come back, is a delicious fish. It's a, you know, under-respected product that's a member of the snapper family. But, you know, I'm here to tell you, if you've ever taken a fresh porgy and put it on a grill and served it whole, it's truly a wonderful meal.
It's funny. I was explaining to someone new on the staff at one of our restaurants, an Italian restaurant, something of the Italian food culture, and that the whole thing is, it's about the place and what happens in the place and having hundreds or thousands of years of cultivating a particular product or being available one particular quality of product in one particular place. If there's a particular kind of shrimp that you find in one bay, people will drive, you know, across the entire country to go to this little town at this time of year to eat in these little restaurants that are, you know, completely, the menus are short and just entirely populated with those shrimp, and that's it.
Right, I couldn't agree with you more. It seems that, you know, this new age of restaurant goer is, you know, it's almost back to the dine and dash days. That people should, you know, you as a chef, you take your talents, you go out, you find the proper ingredients, and you want to know where that product comes from and what it's all about. It seems like we're getting away from that a little bit, and that's very disappointing because the one thing that's so enjoyable about seafood is that everything has a story and everything has an origin where it comes from and why it's there and why it has these certain flavors. And as you mentioned, during this time of the year, whether it's getting ready to spawn or migrate or it's feeding on a certain fish that's only there for a short period of time, there's all these wonderful stories, and people don't take the time to find out about them.
Speaking of which, can you say why ivory salmon is the color that it is? Can we talk a little bit about salmon in general?
Sure.
Farm-raised versus wild? I think that would be good for people to hear.
Well, to answer your question first, it's kind of the answer is kind of the opposite thing. The ivory salmon isn't really the color. It's because it's lacking color. It just doesn't pick up the pigments that your normal wild salmon normally has from eating shrimp or whatnot.
Okay.
So it's fun. There's ivory salmon, which is pretty pale, and it's sort of self-explanatory. But there's also a calico salmon, they call, and the meat's kind of molted color, and it's kind of interesting. And then, of course, you have the red. And the interesting thing is they all taste the same. They all taste very good, and they're all. Mm-hmm. And we'll see that sometimes in the king salmon, and we'll select them out.
It's just a question of sizing and freshness, right?
Not so much sizing and freshness. It's just the characteristic, it's the genetic makeup of the salmon, of whether or not it's incorporating the pigments from the shrimp that it's eating. Hmm. Sort of like red hair, brown hair, blonde hair.
Got it. And talk about farm salmon versus wild salmon.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up because, you know, farm salmon and aquaculture in general gets a extremely bad rap,
right,
as far as healthiness or many, many different things, none of which I choose to perpetuate. But the most important thing is that aquaculture, and especially salmon, is very successful. You know, 40 years ago in Norway, there may have been some issues, just like with any industry starting out.
Sure.
But over the years, they've really not only perfected the science of salmon farming, but also the art of it. The products that are coming out of the farms now are very high quality. They're very good tasting and are very good for you. And it's just a shame that all these rumors still linger.
I agree. As a chef, you know, you want, obviously I buy the best product I can, and I do buy some farmed salmon, and I stand behind it, and I know that there are, you know, guests that may be concerned about it. So I think it's good to have a professional say, you know, these farming practices are good.
Yeah, they've improved them over the years, and some of the things that are not only, they just make sense. I mean, one of the problems they used to have was overfeeding of the fish. Now, and that was a problem because they overfeed the fish, the food pellets fall through the water column to the bottom, and then they could create a problem in the benthic environment. Nowadays, with the technologies they have and the high-quality feeds, they actually have cameras and lasers to detect, you know, the proper amount of feed to put into the pens. So that way, when the fish are done feeding, the cameras and the lasers detect the pellets falling through the water columns, and it shuts off the feed automatically, so they don't have this overfeeding issue. So,
good. Well,
and the
you.
Other thing is the salmon feed is very high quality, which means it's very expensive. So the farmer himself doesn't want to waste this product, and you know, because it's an expensive venture to run an aquaculture facility.
Well, thank you for explaining that.
So, Joe, one last question before you go. What is one pet, not a pet fish, but one fish that you feel like people should know about, or that is fantastic availability, or fantastic quality, fantastic pricing, that seems like it doesn't hold in the market?
Yeah, it's something that has a very good quality and it kind of underappreciated and maybe hasn't found its time yet.
Exactly.
There would be the one fish that we've had a lot of initial success with that I feel falls under this category. It is aquacultured, but it has a very nice fat content to it without being overpowering. So it gives the fish a nice flavor and allows you, and it cooks well. It's always, I find, when you cook a fish, it has a little bit of an oil content to it. It just browns up nicely. And that's the fish right now is coming in from Bali, and it's the barramundi. I don't know if you've ever used that.
Yeah.
But it's a delicious fish. It also lends itself to allowing it to be cooked with the skin on it, so it crisps up. I don't know if you like salmon skin, but the barramundi skin is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And, I really enjoy that fish, and I recommend it to my friends, and I take it home myself quite frequently.
Very good.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming on the program. We really appreciate your insight and your experience.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and it's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Joe.
Of course.
Have a good day.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.
When we come back on Formidable Fun Food and Wine, we'll get into some seafood recipes on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And so now we've got a little background.
That was great.
Yeah. It was.
Thanks to Joe.
Interesting to be speaking with someone who has been bringing fish to market and bringing fish to restaurants and to,
that's a long
time. And to the public as long as we've been in kitchens.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, he sounds like he got started when we both got started. So that's pretty cool.
So we think you feel like you know the evolution of the industry, but it's interesting to hear it with a little bit, drier perspective, let's say.
Right. And I remember the whole swordfish thing. I mean, it was so popular when I first started working in South Carolina. And oh, my gosh. I mean, and then I remember the time where you just didn't buy it because you knew it had been overfished and it was irresponsible to buy it. And
the most popular menu item at the Occidental in Washington, D.C. at lunch was a swordfish club.
Ooh, yummy.
Yeah. And,
that's funny.
And it just all of a sudden died. I mean, the menu item just died.
Yeah.
Because of, D.C. is the world capital of political correctness.
Sure.
So.
Sure. Well.
Up until now.
I was going to say it used to be. Anyway.
Yeah, let's move forward. So what seafood do you love to cook? What has been, in the last year, what have you found that you've been most excited to cook or not cook?
Oh,
I know
no.
you, it's... I've watched your evolution in learning to love raw fish.
Oh, and we've been getting black sea bass. Oh, it's so beautiful. First of all, it's beautiful. It really is beautiful to look at, but the skin is just gorgeous. And, if you take your knife edge and run it along the skin and really clean it up before you go to, if you do grill it, and it's a good way to really kind of dry the skin on the fish by using your knife blade. Obviously, my point is to take every single scale off because nobody wants to eat a scale. But, oh my gosh, it's so good. And it really has a great flavor. It's not strong or oily, but it's also not Dover sole, which is probably one of the most beautiful fish in the world. But on the sweet, really clean, really
mild
end of the scale. Right. So that being at that end of the scale.
I think of Dover sole as being almost a foil for butter.
Oh my gosh. Why not? And why not? But yeah, with black sea bass, I just feel like it has, more flavor and really gorgeous. And, using it for ceviche or tartare or any raw purpose. It's a gorgeous fish for that. So I've definitely fallen in love with that lately. I buy a lot of it.
So how about a black sea bass ceviche recipe? Now, you don't marinate the seafood. You do it a la minute.
Right. We have to start with that, which is obviously the traditional method of making ceviche is to marinate the seafood in acid for a period of time. Could be hours or longer. I actually put my marinade on the fish as we plate it and as a guest is eating it. And what our traditional marinade that I use for rockfish, because I've been doing wild rockfish ceviche for many years, is everything finely chopped. Finely chopped jalapeno, no seed, no pith. Cilantro, either red onion or shallot. And then extra virgin olive oil. If it can't be strong, so it has to be a mild extra virgin, and then fresh lime, fresh lemon, salt, and pepper, and we add sea salt to the fish for the crunch as we plate it. So you don't want to put too much salt in your marinade.
So you're laying out, very
thin slices of fish on the plate.
Cut thin slices of fish on the plate like sashimi.
On a cold plate, exactly.
Yeah, like sashimi, and then you just paint it with the
right. It's a swath of it sort of down the middle of the fish. And we usually put maybe up to 6 thin slices on the plate. And it's really, and we buy small fish, and it's really beautiful. So with the black sea bass, the first time I did that, I took pink peppercorns and just crushed them in my hand, which leaves you with the peppercorn and the pink sort of shell, outer shell, and just let the pink outer shell go all over the fish, finely chopped chives, black benne seeds, white or sesame seeds, as we call them here. So the black and the white, and again, salt and pepper, and obviously a good oil, and grapefruit juice, which was just pink grapefruit juice. And I make supremes of pink grapefruit and actually cut it into tiny pieces and scatter that around as well. And with the seeds and the citrus and the sort of inherent onion flavor, obviously delicate flavor of a little chive. Really pretty. So that's, one of my favorite things with the black sea bass. But you could certainly do the other marinade with the black sea bass as well.
With the sesame seeds, both black and white, you toast them a little bit first.
I do toast them, yeah. And that's super important. And actually, the same mill that we get our grits stone ground for us and our polenta, well, we get a lot of products from the mill in South Carolina, but they produce a traditional benne seed, and that is really, really brilliant. And you can probably buy them online.
It's just more likely a fresher sesame seed.
Right. I'll tell you the name of the mill. It's called Anson's Mill. And really do, if you have an interest, look online at their website.
So we'll provide a link to the Anson's Mill website so listeners can check that out.
Oh, my goodness. The real benne seed is really, really flavorful. And they toast, and I would give you a hint that when you are toasting something like that, let's say you're doing it in a saute pan on the stove on low heat, and you're just sort of gently, constantly tossing them in the pan so that they toast evenly, is that once you smell and that oil starts to come out of the sesame seed, you want to remove them immediately from the pan. Because, just the heat from that pan will carry over and could possibly take them over or even burn them.
So you're just trying to bring the oil out and the aroma up. You're not trying to color them or dry them.
Right, right. So just get them out of that pan onto something cool immediately. And toasting them really makes a big difference in how they taste. And it's really pretty with the fish.
So what else are you excited about? I mean, how many thousands and thousands of soft-shell crabs have you cooked?
I love soft-shell.
Right?
And it's funny because when I was a kid, I didn't grow up here. I never had a soft-shell crab until I started cooking.
I remember showing one to you, and you were what in the hell is wrong with you?
Right.
That is a spider.
And it's interesting. It's interesting. A friend of mine, and I reposted it, posted a video of the soft-shell crab, of the hard crab shedding its shell and turning into the soft-shell. It's fascinating. It's a time-lapse video, and I was really happy to see that because it is kind of amazing, the process. But, that's obviously what the soft-shell is. It's lost its hard shell. And you want to be on top of that. So you want to get them when they've just shed their shell and they are still soft, and then they're completely super desirable. And, you know, I do a very quick process with them. We clean them obviously properly, and don't forget to remove the feathery lungs from underneath the top shell. I'm sure everybody knows the process of cleaning a crab here, but marinating them to order in buttermilk.
I was going to say, I think everyone who is here is not from here.
Well, that's true. So you
take us for cleaning
the crab. You do lift up the sides, and underneath are their lungs, and it kind of looks like white feathers. And that is absolutely not digestible. So you do want to cut all of that off down to the end, and then you flip it over and you cut, I forget what it's called, but it's the piece on the back that you can flip up, and it's either the Empire State Building or the Washington Monument. I forget how it goes, but one means female, one means male crab. And now people are laughing at me because I'm sure people know that. But anyway, you pull that up and you cut it off.
The rabbi is applauding you right now.
And then you, I hate to say it, I don't know how else to say it, but you cut their face off. I'm sorry. And you just want to cut as little of that off. And
you just single-handedly dropped the price of soft-shell crabs in the market. Good job.
And then when you have done that, you have to cut into where their, I guess it's their brain cavity. You asked me to tell them.
Of course
I did. You have to pop that bubble that's in there, or it's going to pop on you when you're frying them, and you're not going to like it because it's going to burn you. So you do not want to miss that step either. You don't want to miss any of the steps in cleaning the crab. And I'm certain there's a video online to show you that, which a visual aid is much better than hearing me talk about it.
I just wanted to hear watch you make faces as you explained it.
I just wanted to hear you say, cut their face off. So then it goes into the buttermilk marinade, which is right before you serve them. They don't need to sit in there. This is how I do it.
So you have the crab prepared. Then it goes into your buttermilk marinade.
Mm-hmm. And then I use the same breading procedure I do for my oysters, which is cornmeal, very fine grind, cornmeal, all-purpose flour, a tiny bit of salt, and a tiny bit of cayenne pepper. And when you do go to bread them, you want it to be very light coating. So, you know, dip in and out, get it out of there. And I fry in a 350-degree fryer in peanut oil. So if you're doing it on your stove, you do want to aim for 350 degrees. It's a perfect temperature. Just use a thermometer to check that out. Obviously, I would caution you anytime you're deep frying at home, it can be a difficult and messy procedure, even just from the smell in your home and the oil that goes out into the air as you're cooking with it and getting on your paintings in your kitchen or whatever you have hanging in your kitchen. So don't do a lot of deep frying at home. You could always shallow you could shallow fry them
I think a lot of people don't want to go through the whole procedure.
Right.
And they like to think of doing it lighter. They want to do it without the breading I think it is reasonable if you have a really big, I found if you have almost like using a wok, if you have a really big Teflon coated pan,
mm-hmm.
and you just very quickly get it very hot and have an appropriate, like same amount of oil you put in to cook a piece of fish, a pretty decent amount of oil so it doesn't stick. You just season the crab and get it going in there, and you can flip it just like an omelet.
Yeah.
And get it pretty crispy on both sides. And that's a nice way to do that. If you're doing it with a cold preparation of some sort, say you're doing it with a salad, or honestly, if you're doing something that's Asian inspired and it's with a stir fry of vegetables or something like that, that's great to do with a soft crab. It does take a little bit longer. That's why use the high heat and keep that sucker moving.
Mm-hmm. I occasionally have to cook it that way. I guess we'll ask, and I mean, we're happy to if that's what they want. But it does. Yeah, that's the only thing. It goes from taking about a minute and a half to probably 4 to 5 minutes. So just be aware of that, because you do want it to get obviously hot and cooked all the way through the center. And if you're immersed in fat, it's a very, very different cooking procedure than being in a pan with just a very little bit of fat. But both ways can be very, very good. You know, you talk about accompaniments. For a long time, I did a Napa cabbage slaw for my crab cakes, you know, just sort of a little play on the whole cabbage crab sandwich. And I think sometimes about putting that with the soft shell. I just think that would be so good. that salad does have mayonnaise in it, so I would keep it as little as possible. But wash it very well. Julienne the Napa cabbage, which is very pretty and absolutely delicious.
Soft crabs and essentially really fancy coleslaw are a great idea.
It's good. and I do put a little bit of whole grain mustard, mix it in with my mayonnaise, a tiny bit of lemon juice, and if you want a little spice, a tiny bit of Tabasco and freshly ground black pepper. And I would put a little bit of salt in as well. And just, as I said, dress the greens, the cabbage as little as possible, and you know, make a little slaw for your plate. And you could always add, maybe you like poblano peppers, you could add a julienne of that to that, or jalapeno peppers if you really do like spice, or even a habanero pepper, could a little bit going in there. You could add arugula to that. There are a lot of things you could add to, you know, fit your personal likes.
Mustard greens is something that I like.
Mustard greens would be fantastic. Yeah, so that's fun. I think that's a fun way. And I also serve my soft shells with lemon brown butter, which is, I'm sorry, my absolute favorite way to eat them. I just think it's perfect for them.
Yeah, you can take the girl out of the South, but you can't take the French out of her soul, right?
So that's right. It is, two parts of me.
So, I mean, I think the other thing that's funny, I was thinking about, he was talking about the Chesapeake and oysters coming back.
Oh,
it made me think immediately of clams. And the level of affection that people have for spaghetti with clams, I think it is really rare to get it made really, really well. I think it can be incredibly good.
It sure can.
That if you have fresh spaghetti, if you want to do with egg pasta, that's nice. But honestly, more appropriately, and this is not something you do. I don't think you do it with red sauce. You know, I like to open the clams in good white wine with plenty of garlic and a little bit of mirepoix and bay leaf and peppercorns. Mm-hmm. And it's the blending of the juice from the clam
definitely
and the wine that's going to make the...
That's going to be so good.
It's going to make the spaghetti work. And
right.
It's just the moment that they open, that's when you want to get the pasta out of that cooker. If you made fresh pasta, make it with the durum and make it not eggs.
Durum wheat.
And make it in the morning, cut your spaghetti, cut your noodles. You know, if you can do it by hand with a knife... If you need reading glasses like I do now in order to handle a knife, God love you.
Jeez.
but if you can just you can dry them over a dowel or over a broomstick, something like that. Or you can certainly go and get very fine spaghetti. There's a producer from Abruzzo that's quite good.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can cook that and drop that right in the pan with those clams and the little bit of liquor that opened them up, don't leave the top on that pot.
Mm-mm.
But you're going to cook those clams with the spaghetti for a little while. And that what I will do then is pull the garlic out, sliver that garlic that's already poached in the wine and has been poaching with the liquor, and toss some of that back in there. Toss some fresh chilies in there, like Fresnos.
Yeah.
Fresnos are really variable in their heat. So if you don't taste one, you don't know if you have a sweeter one or a hotter one. You may not know how much heat you're adding, so for goodness sake, taste the ones that you're adding in there. But I would sliver the garlic, I would sliver the chilies, and you honestly need a small mountain of fresh Italian flat leaf parsley. And if you with that parsley, the freshness of it's a big deal because it actually has oil to release with the pasta. So when you go to plate that pasta, you're pulling the spaghetti with a little bit of fine mirepoix and out of there, twirling that. All the garnish, can go out of there onto the spaghetti. But all the flavor has already been absorbed. There's not a sauce, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
All the juice has been absorbed by the spaghetti. The moisture should be good after about two and a half minutes of cooking. So that's the point at which you pull your clams out and go ahead and garnish your spaghetti with that. But a lot of very generous handful of the parsley is a very big deal. And I think if you use a stronger herb, you lose the clams almost entirely.
Well, sounds good.
When we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, we'll get into our chef's challenge after a few minutes on fish and seafood with wine. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
I was just thinking about Buñuelos. Remember the little like seafood donuts that you get in Spain?
Really, really special.
They can be with shrimp, they can be with crab, they can be with lobster meat. I had in Galicia with lobster meat that were...
Oh, my goodness.
Holy moly.
Yeah. If you go to Spain, you have to get buñuelos.
Buñuelos, yeah, yeah. It's a fun tapa, but mostly you get really good ones. And if you go into a relatively fancy place, you see so much good seafood there. So I have little dreams about silly seafood dishes like that. What are your seafood dish dreams? What's your short list of favorite?
I have to say, I just love lobster. And really, truly, well, when I was in culinary school, my aunt and uncle lived not too far away from where I was. And it was nice to be able to go visit them sometimes on the weekend. And they were big lobster lovers. And just the simplicity of, you know, boiling lobsters and sitting out on their back porch and having, you know, cocktail sauce and drawn butter. And they had an amazing garden. My uncle was a farmer before he became a pilot. And so
it's a normal transition.
Yeah. Well, he was a genius. He could do anything he wanted to. And he was also a woodworker. He had a woodworking shop in his basement. He was a phenomenal man. But anyway, so they had a great garden. And my aunt did a tremendous amount of canning and freezing and preserving every year. And so we would either have some sort of preserved fruit if there wasn't something available at that time, or we'd have a big salad if it was summertime. And yeah, I have to say, I really do like the idea of sitting down and eating, you know, the whole lobster.
Really fantastic whole lobster. Super simple preparation is the all-time, like a lobster roll is the all-time excuse for a big, fat American Chardonnay. I mean, one of those great big West Coast, kind of toasty. I love lobsters and corn together.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the two things that are always like, I want those two things. If I could improve upon a lobster roll, it would be to have just like fresh hot, the whole lobster and a big skillet of cornbread and maybe and some ridiculous Chardonnay for Mark Aubert or Mount Eden down in Santa Cruz you know, one of the really good guys. Those wines, I don't want them for every dish, but that, absolutely.
What about for raw oysters?
It depends upon exactly what you're doing with the oyster to me. If you're keeping it very simple, then something very clean and very dry shows off the oyster. If there's a tiny bit of sweetness to it, like if you're going to serve Chablis with it, make sure it's more ripe here, like, 10, 12, 15, even some of the 13s show well. Because the saltiness of the oyster is going to show off that little bit of fruit, but it's going to tie in with the minerality of the wine. And there's not really appreciable density or heavy structure to the wine. Muscadet is a classic match, but Muscadet is not a good purchase very often anymore. Champagne is a great match for a lot of oysters. Mm. If you have a very vinegary preparation, if you put a lot of mignonette sauce or you're putting cocktail sauce or something on oysters, for God's sake, have a beer. But you know,
I was waiting to hear what the answer was. I didn't realize it was going to be that. Okay, I mean, that sounds good.
I'm perfectly happy to stand up at Lexington Market and ask them to shuck oysters at Fadley Seafood and stand and drink a can of beer.
There you go. Sounds good.
And that I will actually just put cocktail sauce on. But if it's just lemon or a delicate preparation, it's wine that I want and something clean.
How about a fish?
You got to pick a fish. Something like trout is a whole nother ball game.
Right. I was going to say with salmon, it's so fatty. And then
and salmon depends on preparation there's some salmon dishes that I want Pinot Noir for in a heartbeat. Or even like yummy, really pretty Grenache-driven Chardonnay of the Pop, believe it or not.
Right. Yeah.
If it's like with, you know.
So there's your fish with
black
red wine.
Black beans and red wine sauce and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Your famous Parker salmon dish. Let's take that one for example.
Roasted shallot and red wine reduction, wilted baby spinach and crispy potatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was often with Cote Rôti for a tasting for him, you know, so that.
Well, are there any other fish? And I know we're talking preparation, but is there a fish that comes to mind that you would?
There are fish that lend themselves for richer preparations. Right. I mean, that's the reality of it. Things that monkfish has a texture that. And there's certain things, mushrooms, Beans with lots of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Beets, you know, any of those things, kind of
dark,
earthier flavors.
Dark, earthier, yeah.
Earthier flavors.
Collard greens, if you did fish with collard greens, right? Or what do you think?
Depends how spicy.
If there's not too much
vinegar.
Depends
how spicy the greens are.
Yeah.
You know me, I'm going to get extremely specific about all that kind
sure,
of stuff.
Sure, of course. Well, and with like fish like sturgeon and you know, if
sturgeon,
you have...
Sturgeon's so meaty, mm-hmm. exactly.
And oil, yeah, super oily. And with something like shrimp, is there, you know, let's just say shrimp with, if I was going to do...
Shrimp,
I think this is kind of
sweet.
Scary. Right, yeah, but if I did with avocado puree and let's say, you know, a citrusy vinaigrette on the plate and maybe had rice on the plate with that and I grilled shrimp at my house.
That's easy. You just need really good Sauvignon Blanc with a tiny bit of oak.
Okay.
Maybe white wine from Bordeaux.
Okay, cool.
Some of the 14 whites in Bordeaux are quite good and there's some that are not terribly expensive.
Okay, sounds good.
So.
Thanks.
Sure. And so let's, I know you've been avoiding the chef's challenge. So.
Never.
We're going to give you yours first.
Chef's challenge. All right. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So black grouper, which is a great variety of grouper, and grouper is super sweet, beautiful fish, and flakes into big flakes.
That's
so
a good flavor.
I love grouper, yeah. And it's an interesting fish to cook. It is a fish that definitely lends itself to being poached as well as sautéed or grilled. So it's kind of nice that you can do what you want with it.
I think
it.
Of that as being a very complete fish. It doesn't mm-hmm. it doesn't hide away from anything.
Is it a whole fish?
It's a whole
fish.
I
would really like to cook a whole fish. So you gave me celery.
Well, the grouper, if you have like a 3-pound grouper, you know you're only going to get about a pound and a half of meat.
Right. So I have oregano. No, those are oranges. I can't read your writing, Foreman. Basil. And this is funny that you gave me jamon ibérico. I gave you jamon ibérico.
Well, jamon ibérico is good.
Ibérico ham. That's funny that we gave each other the same ingredient.
I gave it to you in Spanish.
All right. Thyme. All right. So I'm going to put the celery and the lemons and the thyme and some of the garlic and just some of those things inside the cavity of the grouper and rub it well with oil and kosher salt and pepper inside and outside. And I'm going to put it on my grill. And I have to elevate my grill cooking surface a little bit to do that. And
because you don't want it smoking hot.
I don't. And
you don't
I
flame
don't
want
to char
the skin of the fish.
I don't. Yeah. Right. I definitely don't want to flame it. So I'm going to cook it on very low heat for a while and to the point where I'm going to actually go for the point of flaking because I think it's just going to be amazing. And
it's a lot better to fillet it too.
Yeah, exactly. And also you've given me Niçoise olives, which are awesome because I will love that with the grouper. And the other ingredients you gave me were squid, whole fresh squid, fresh oranges, the basil, butter, extra virgin olive oil from Ligaria, jamon ibérico, and fresh baguette, 2 bottles of Verdicchio. Oh, goody.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm going to keep you busy while you cook.
The jamon ibérico absolutely is with the extra virgin olive oil and the baguette on the table with the wine.
So there's your
paper
first
thin slices. Yeah, everybody's enjoying that.
Very complicated first course.
And hopefully we're outside and I'm grilling and this is outside with me, with the people while I'm grilling and not in the house. And the squid, I'm going to just use the tube part of the squid. And there's a bone, I guess.
They grill up nicely.
Yeah, you have to just remember when you're cooking this or dealing with the squid that you have to clean it properly. There's a clear bone, if you will, that's in it and that you need to remove it. It almost looks like plastic wrap, but it's hard. And so that needs to be removed. And I am going to grill the squid. And that will actually, I'm going to serve it with the grouper. This is just going to be kind of all one dish. And that will get the orange juice and the basil and some of the extra virgin olive oil and salt and pepper. And then that will be the garnish for that gorgeous grouper. And I think I'll just roughly chop some of the Niçoise olives, the garlic, the Roma tomato, a little bit of the remaining celery, add a little lemon, and make up just a little relish and serve that for the grouper. And you can just put it on your fish as you will. And I'm definitely going to put a little bit of the butter that you gave me on the fish after the skin is removed and it's taken off the bone.
Shocking.
That sounds good. I could eat that.
Yeah.
Now.
That sounds nice.
I'm so hungry.
The squid is a garnish for the grouper is, yeah.
That'll be fun.
I like that very much. All right. Do you have a challenge for me or?
Yeah, right. Oh, do you want me to give it to you?
Yeah, you could.
You want me to
How
hand it
that?
To you? Here you go.
Yeah, I'm looking for full service here.
All right.
Let's see. Octopus, garlic, Italian flat leaf parsley, shallot, basil, lemon, lime, extra virgin olive oil, plum tomato, lobster, shrimp, branzino, arborio rice, reggiano, arugula, iberico ham. Okay, that's okay. It's a lot of stuff. The question is always about like quantities and all that kind of business, because my first instinct is to make a risotto as a first course with some of the other seafood and serve the octopus and the branzino off the grill as a main course. Mm-hmm. You know, first thing you got to do is poach that octopus and get it to where it's tender and rest it. We don't have the time for that whole drama, but assume that that has been done. And that for the grilled items, the branzino and the octopus, you need a sauce. Did you give me anything to work with? Arugula, garlic, basil, shallot. Do I have lemons?
Sure.
Can I get a lemon?
Mm-hmm.
Then I would make essentially like a pesto with the arugula and a little bit of basil and citrus. You did give me the citrus. And a little shallot and garlic. And have that as a salsa verde, if you will, the Italian version, for the octopus and the branzino when they come off the grill. And I'm just going to simply salt them and grill them with slices of the lime in the cavity there. Mm-hmm. And serve them extra virgin olive oil and salsa verde. Done. And then lobster and shrimp, I'm going to use small quantities of that. Cut them very small. I'm going to start my risotto. And do I have butter? No.
You can assume you have a pantry.
I'm going to assume that's look at me asking for butter. I'm going to make a risotto with arborio rice and finish it with a little brunoise of the jamon and the shrimp and the lobster and a whole bunch of the flat leaf parsley.
Great.
To finish that, no cheese. I will admit I do follow the old-fashioned rule of the no cheese with seafood and
right.
Italian cooking. So,
mm-hmm, definitely.
But I serve the risotto first and then the grilled fish. And alongside the grilled fish, those plum tomatoes that you gave me, I would serve them with salt and the basil and tiny little, literally like shaved shallot.
It's funny we gave each other so many of the same ingredients.
Well, it's
it goes with seafood.
It's summertime. It's seafood. It's, you know, you want simple, beautiful stuff.
Yep. Okay.
So what do you want to drink with the dish that you made with the grouper, right?
Oh, I don't know. Why don't you just tell me? It's a lot easier. I don't know.
Maybe a 2013 Merso, like Village Level Merso or something like that.
Yeah, see, that would have just...
Good fruit, clean.
Gone right off
not
my
too much
tongue.
Wood on that, yeah. But enough to... Like, I know how rich you're going to make it. It needs to be Burgundy and not somewhere else.
Okay.
Mine is easy. You know, it's going to be... My stuff will be lighter and a little more delicate as my personality lends itself to that direction. And maybe some just real charmer from the south of Italy, like a falanghina or something like that.
Okay. Falanghina.
So.
Sounds good.
Anyway, I think that's all we've got time for. On Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And if you want to follow Cindy Wolf on social media.
You can follow me on Twitter at Chef Cindy Wolf or on Instagram at Chef Wolf.
And if you wish to download this or any other podcast that you've missed, please go to the WYPR website, look up the Foreman & Wolf page, and go to town. Thanks for listening.
Have a good Sunday.